Thank you very much, Al. Some of you probably remember, a while back that there was a man named Ernest Boyer who talked about types of faculty scholarship. So certainly when I think about this kind of field and teaching, then faculty scholarship comes to mind. He looked at different ways, a broader way, to define what types of scholarship would be appropriate for faculty and should be considered in promotion and tenure decision. He talked about the scholarship of discovery, which is the typical kind of research that we always do. He also talked about a new kind of scholarship that he called the scholarship of integration. And this type of scholarship was what happens when you meld two fields, when you're working on the edges of two fields, on the cusp, where they intersect. And as he wrote about this, he thought that this was the most exciting, the most promising, creative kind of scholarship that we could be doing. And then certainly the scholarship of application, how what we are learning gets applied in practice. And finally, the scholarship of teaching, how we look at the whole pedagogical experience. This field provides legitimization and validation for work that people have been doing. It gives us a title and makes it such that, to those of us for whom that's important, we're more likely to be able to claim this for promotion and tenure decisions. It makes a difference to faculty that they can do work in a field that's validated. It opens a critical dialogue that increases our understanding. It gives us more comprehensive ways of looking at the problems from all of our fields. And when I think about epidemiology is the foundational field for all of us in public health. So I'm going to talk about different disciplines, but I see, but certainly you know that for all that we do, that epidemiology is our foundation. So it provides a bridge for us then to open dialogue on some of these other fields. It provides us a broader view for our research, the opportunity to look at community and environmental factors through different eyes than we've looked at them before, as we view them with our colleagues in criminology. Both the commonalities and the differences between our disciplines can lead to more accurate and sharply focused research problems. I also want to talk to you a little bit, and I'm trying to be brief, about intersections, substantive intersections, because moving beyond both methodology and theory, we come to how do we really work together? What does this mean on the ground? And this is what we're interested in education. Let me give you an example from my college. People in our Justice Center have done very good work on sexual assault against women. In Alaska, this is sexual assault against women is one of our most prevalent problems, and we probably have a greater incidence than most other states. This is especially true for Alaska Native women. Some of the researchers in our Justice Center, some of the faculty, have done work on mapping the incidence of sexual assault across the city and looking at the whole picture of that. Who is doing it? Who is the victim of that? Under what conditions does this happen? What time does it happen? Were they drinking? Just many, many questions. And based on that work, they were able to provide counsel to the police about where they could, in what cases they might try to prevent sexual assault, and in what cases of sexual assault, it didn't make very much sense to try to prevent it because it was happening indoors and in family homes. This is an example of a substantive issue that all of our units could coalesce around. So we had people, faculty in public health that did work with maternal child health and women's health, and nurses that did sexual assault response that could get involved. When we think about the counseling opportunities after this, certainly social work, human services. To the extent that people with disabilities are victimized by sexual assault, this became an issue for our Center for Human Development. Even our gerontology piece with our Native elders was important, because when you think about crime, antisocial behavior in Native communities, it is often related, alcoholism too, and substance abuse, it's often related to a breakdown of the community structure. And the community structure in Alaska Native communities depends very much on the ascendance of elders in the community. When that breaks down, all kinds of things break down. So the opportunity to bring many of our disciplines together around this substantive issue is certainly there. We have many other areas where we can intersect. Implications of the criminal act for the family of the person who actually does the act and goes to prison, for the family of the victims, for the communities in which they live. There are issues about health status and health promotion, health care during a time a person's in prison. There are vulnerable prison populations, such as women and children, pregnant women, aging prisoners, prisoners with a disability and mental illness, prisoners with acute and chronic illness. There's the impact on the economic stability of families and communities, leading to poor health and perhaps antisocial behavior that happens as a result of incarceration. So there are many, many areas in which we can think that not only can we do scholarship, we can do collaborative teaching. There are opportunities for involving students in collaborative joint projects and service learning around all of these issues, both for the families, the victims, the perpetrators, their families, whoever. And finally, I'll quickly talk a little bit about areas of shared concerns in ethics and human rights. Ethics, of course, are the moral standards that we impose on ourselves as we care for whoever our client or patient is. Human rights are rights, legal claims that we that are codified in international law that we can make against governments on the basis of our being human, basic rights, the right to life, liberty, non-discrimination, respect and dignity. Many of us believe that healthcare is also one of these rights, and there's certainly much written in the human rights literature, which I won't go into now, about the rights of prisoners, the rights of people with mental health, the rights of people with disabilities. All of these come into play. This is, I think, an area of very important dialogue that needs to go on as we think about our ethical, our human rights responsibilities to not only prisoners, but to victims, to families, to everyone that's part of that equation. And sometimes these dialogues can be difficult, but I think as we as practitioners, as teachers, and our students engage in these kinds of dialogues, I think important understandings can come out of this, which will lay a foundation for trust and collaboration as we move forward. And I'm going to stop right there.
Thank you, President Easley, for getting over here. We've had quite a few new folks, so let me just briefly, before Professor Akers gets up, we're going to move from the president of the APHA to the past president of the American Society of Criminology, the largest criminology association in the world. Dr. Ron Akers was, as I said, the developer of social learning theory in the mid-1960s from a symbolic interactionist social behaviorist perspective. He began to apply those approaches to many of the issues that Ralph talked about earlier in the 1970s in his work at Boys Town and other places in Iowa. I've known Ron now since 1980 personally, been a mentor of mine for a long time, and I'm really glad to have him come up and do a little discussant role, and then we'll open up for questions from the audience.
When I heard there was a virtual center, I thought I'd bring virtual slides, so I don't have any slides to show. I'm happy to be here. I'm here by the invitation of Hugh and Tim Akers, who we, in our through emails and discussion, we've decided we're 10th cousins three times removed. We're related in some way, we know, because we have family pictures that look the same. So we know there's some genetic link there somewhere or another. I'm happy to be here. I guess I'm the primary criminologist. I don't really have much link to public health, although I must say that two of my largest research projects have been in collaboration with people in medical schools, the studies of teenage smoking, of elderly drinking and substance use have all been done with in collaboration with people in medical schools that have used epidemiological approaches. I'm not really going to discuss the different presentations. They've all been well done. They all have been very concise and have made some very clear points. I would just make a general observation. That is, anytime you start talking about bringing fields together or the interstitial areas or the places where they come together, I'm always reminded of the distinction between a discipline such as sociology or psychology or political science or economics or whatever, and a field of study. Fields of study are defined by the dependent variables, and criminology is one of those fields. I have the feeling that public health is another one of those. Public health is not defined, and criminology is not defined, by some sort of single integrated theoretical approach, but rather the problems that they're trying to address. And you can address those from a number of different disciplinary perspectives. In criminology, the main dependent variables are causes and correlates of crime and victimization, and causes and correlates of criminal justice behavior and decisions. And it seems to me that there's some parallels there between those dependent variables and dependent variables that have occupied the attention of epidemiological approaches in public health. Now, of course, when you're talking about disease, most of the time the focus is on the victims of those diseases, but we've already seen from what's been said here that you also have to focus on the behavior of people who are violating social norms, who are engaged in risky and other kinds of behavior, antisocial and other kinds of behavior. So in both cases, we're trying to account for the behavior of people through trying to understand the epidemiological distributions of those behaviors and then to add some sort of explanation, some sort of application, and some sort of reaction to that. So you have both an explanation of the behavior and then what do you do about it. And that, of course, in the case of crime involves a criminal justice system, overlapping with, in the case of health, the public health system. What I really wanted to do was to just mention briefly the place of epidemiology in criminology, and then to end with a brief reference to the theory that Hume just mentioned, a theory that I've been working with since the 60s, which is a integration of principles, of sociological principles of group interaction with psychological principles of behaviorism, primarily cognitive and behavioral approach. The understanding of epidemiology and criminology goes back a long way, and it is understood, as Hugh mentioned earlier in his opening remarks, the distribution of crime rates across social demographic categories and space. That seems to me is what epidemiology is, and that has a very long history in criminology. The epidemiology of crime and victimization is seen in the variations by age, race, ethnicity, social class, gender, and other social demographic variables, many of which have already been mentioned here by the panelists. It's always been central to research and theory in criminology, both as control variables and explanatory variables. So if you say epidemiology to a criminologist, it's not a surprise. It's not a new subject. Criminology has been dealing with this for a long time. The classic statement of this after these earlier studies that was mentioned by Hugh Durkheim and Quachile and others like that, the classic statement that is in a 1960s piece by Donald Cressy, who is a former president of the Pacific Sociological Association, and in his presidential address, he read a paper called Epidemiology and Individual Conduct, and he was talking about criminal behavior. He later published a book in which he had a section called The Epidemiology of Delinquency and Crime. Also, when we talk about epidemiology, we often use terms like risk behavior and protective factors and insulating factors and so on. And again, you go back to the 60s with a criminologist by the name of Walter Reckless, who had a model in which he talked about categorical risk and insulating factors, not protective factors. There's a whole about 25 years of research and prevention projects out in Seattle. That is the Seattle Social Development Model by Hawkins and Catalano. These guys have been developing models based on learning and bonding concepts that look very much like what was called for here a moment ago. Let's go back to early childhood. Let's start doing some preventive things in the community, the schools, peer groups, and the family, and see if we can have impact on later risky behaviors such as involvement in substance use, involvement in delinquency, involvement in the criminal justice system. And they've had some fairly successful programs. As you all know, no program is hugely successful, but they at least had some modest success. So again, I think the concepts that have been mentioned here, most criminologists would feel quite at home with them. This is not, so if you're talking about a virtual center that will involve criminologists in some way, they won't be strangers to this. This will be something to be quite familiar to them. And also I think you would say from a theoretical point of view, and that's my main area in criminology, is theoretical criminology. Some theories in criminology pick out certain aspects of epidemiology. They pick out certain sociodemographic categories, and that becomes their main focus. So, for instance, if you ask about race and class, then there's a whole school of thought called conflict criminology or radical or Marxist criminology, and they think that everything should revolve around that, race and class. That's the only thing you have to, if we can get our handle on that, we've got a handle on everything. The feminists, of course, think it's gender. And so they think the whole field should be revolving around gender. Life course criminologists think it's age. There's a lot of other perspectives that make use of one or more epidemiological categories. Most of the theories don't stick with just one of them. They think all of them need to be taken into account. Now, as a social learning theorist, my primary focus through the years has been on understanding differences across individuals. Let's look at their learning history. Let's look at the associations they have, particularly peer associations. Let's look at the attitudes they've developed. Let's look at the models to which they've been exposed to. Let's look at the patterns of rewards and punishers, differential reinforcement. All of those factors come into play to account for differences across individuals in their criminal behavior. And I always have to say victimization, because we've learned in criminology the correlates and causes of criminal behavior look very much like the causes and correlates of criminal victimization. The same epidemiological categories, and we've already seen this, that are high in criminal behavior, also high in criminal victimization. And of course, it's already been mentioned here. It seems like there's a concentration of that among teenage and young adult black males with regard to violence, not with regard to everything. I think we have to be careful that there's not every category of deviant criminal behavior is that a high-risk category, but for many things it is. Now, the question is, with that knowledge, what do you do with that? How do you use that to account for victimization and for perpetration of various kinds of criminal behavior? Well, as I say, my focus has always been on that social, psychological, macro level differences across individuals. But another major question that is always there, it's true in public health, it's true in criminology, is, well, what about the differences across the groups? What about the group rates? What about the social rate, any of the difference across social systems, communities, and neighborhoods? Well, I have more recently been working with a model that I call the social structure, social learning model, in which I'm trying to put together. I haven't accomplished this yet, but I've formulated it. It's out there. There's been some research on it, but it's still a work in progress. Of how do you put together these structural categories of causes and correlates with the patterns that we know empirically have been validated have an impact on differences in individual behavior? Well, one of the ways I've done that is I've defined different aspects of social structure, and one of those would be what I call differential location in the social structure. And by that I mean your age, race, gender, class, all of these epidemiological categories. Of course, you can describe individuals by them, but they also tell us, where do you fit into the social structure? And what relevance does that have for your individual behavior? Well, the learning theory says it has a relevance because your location in the social structure has an impact on the very things I've talked about: your attitudes, your exposure to models, your peer group associations, your family, your school experiences, all the things that come into play in individual learning. Those are structured and, in fact, caused by these epidemiological categories. So that's the term I use, differential location and social structure. I have other terms I use, like differential social organization and those, but they all refer to this sort of general hypothesis that social structure, and this includes epidemiology, is hypothesized to affect individual behavior and produce variations in group, community, or societal rates of crime and deviance by affecting the operation of the variables in the social learning process, which in turn then produce the variations in individual behavior. It seems to me a model, something like that, works in public health as well as it does in criminology, that here's the structure, how does it have an impact on differential rates of crime, disease, or whatever you're talking about, and the social learning model I'm working on answer is, it's because it's mediated by these the learning, what I call the learning variables. And those learning variables include many of the things you've already seen in some of these slides, including things like stressors and other things like that. I don't have time to go into what the theory all has to say, but that would be my approach to it. I think that one of the ways in which you can have move from a virtual to a real center is to have theoretical as well as research and application integration. System, what is it? It's about 40%, is that it? Somebody that's in the federal system, what's the percentage? A little less than half.
So
well, your point is well taken. It's a disproportionate number, just that it's not as high as you think it is. It is a disproportionate number. And that is, when I mentioned conflict and radical approaches, that's what they focus on. They have a thing called threat hypothesis. And the argument is that the incarceration rates, the arrest rates, and the sentencing rates are less a function of differences in behavior and on the part of those who are incarcerated and more a function of the application of power of those who want to handle what they think of as a threat.
That's a very good question. Yes, ma'am. Could you direct it to them also?
Yeah, it's for everybody. It's more to your epidemiologist, and you made the comparison of comparing a disease and the variables that contribute to disease or crime. To crime, it seems like one of the challenges for this pursuit is if you're looking at a disease, you can go out and uniformly screen people for that disease. You can run a test or you can do a diagnostic. And then you have your very scientifically identified outcome, your variable. But this is quite different because your outcome is subjective. Your outcome is
me take that one if you might. Is the fact is that if you look at primary, secondary, and tertiary forms of public health prevention strategies, primary, what's primary? It's stopping before it starts, right? Epidemiology. The same exact thing used in criminology. You attempt to stop what we call primary prevention before the behavior begins. Cranial lesions on the brain, often identified in criminology as an issue that can affect people as they get older. If they're not, if a kid bangs their head early on in life, and if it's not checked out and neglected over time, it can lead to something.
Very well, but it's called cranology. Crime is determined by whether you're arrested or convicted of it, not by whether you committed it.
Let's answer the question. Let's answer the question. Anybody want to respond to me?
You mentioned education, for instance. What about the gross inequalities in our public educational system? We have huge disparities in our funding on public education. That's not criminology, that's not epidemiology, that's something else.
Yeah, and I'd like to go ahead and ask one question. First, I want to thank the woman that first spoke. I think you brought up a very important point, which is the prison industrial complex as a source of economic stability and making sure that capital is not invested in the minority, or let's say specifically African American. And now if we talk about percentage wise, if African Americans are 12% of the United States population, yet over 50% of the prison population, something is wrong with that.
Absolutely.
And my question is about looking at violence as an epidemic and using epidemiologic theories such as the tipping point when talking about violence and looking at being African Americans or males in particular as an infectious agent, especially when applying this concept of primary prevention. So I'd like for someone to speak about looking at the tipping point and other epidemiologic theories and how that applies and how that can be changed.
So would you get up the mic, please, and ask a very good question? And also the other question, who wants to chime in?
Yeah, you know, I'm not as familiar with the tipping point, but, you know, my presentation earlier used the stress process, you know, coping behaviors, you know, that aren't, you know, just inherent to an individual. They're based on structural forces as a ways of explaining, you know, some of this criminal or homicidal behavior that we see among African-American men. And, you know, I challenge this particular field, this emerging field, to deal with this particular population. I think we failed black men in other areas of public health. We're not talking about a priority health disparity population like black men. This is an opportunity, you know, and this is an opportunity to look at a tipping point, the stress process. How do these relate to some of the rates that we see for black men in the prison system? Yeah. Sure. I mean, that is the challenge in the, you know, in the stress field. But, you know, what we do know is that there are opportunities, qualitative opportunities to understand stress for this population. This is an emerging field, you know, with this kind of opportunity to better define stress for the health disparity, the at-risk population. Yeah. Okay.
Well, please forgive me. It's 2:15. I think there's another presentation ready to start. Thank you all so much. This is the purpose of the
Yes, and I think you're wrong.
This is an opportunity for us men forever.
Definitely. Here, I'll give you. I'd love to. My wife is receiving her PhD in cultural foundation.
Okay.
Has a particular subset in media. And right now, this patient is looking at certain media influences.
Okay. I think if we can put the ball in the camera, you know, we might get some real formal chances to collaborate.
Yeah, because right now, working with that new program, it's a big issue.
Yeah.
And I can actually get more data, support data to the geography of the situation.
Yeah.
Okay. I look forward to it. Do I have your card?
I didn't bring any with me.
So are you?
Let me just write my number down.
Here, just write it down right here.
Okay. Call me so we can exchange emails.
Okay. All right. Have a blessed night.
Good to see you. All right.
Okay. If you're here, I will be here.
All right.
Okay.